Hi there, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is New Books in East Asian Studies. Welcome. I just spoke with Beverly Bossler about her really wonderful new book, Courtesans, Concubines, and the Cult of Female Fidelity. Harvard University Asia Center published this in 2013. Now, make no mistake, this is an important book. It's an exceptionally important book. It's a foundational book, and it's going to be, if it's not already, absolutely required reading for anybody who is interested in reading about or who is writing about China, certainly and especially from the Song period through the Yuan period. And one of the arguments of the book actually is that it's also very important for those of us who work on later periods like the Ming or the Qing. Now, the book itself takes on three shifting, inchoate, morphing, but important categories of women from the Northern Song through the Southern Song and then the Yuan. These are courtesans, concubines, and exemplary women. And it shows in a series of three parts of the book, each situated in one of these three temporal units, how these categories helped form one another, how they changed, how they transformed, and how, in some surprising ways, as you'll hear later on in the interview that's to come, and also as you'll read in the book, how discourses around concubines, around courtesans, around widow virtue, around fidelity of various ways, actually kind of reverberated out and had some pretty interesting and pretty important and, like I said, pretty surprising ramifications more broadly for the social, cultural, intellectual, and political history of China. It's a really wonderful book, and whether you're a historian or someone who just likes reading about or listening to discussions about China, you'll get something out of it. It's full of not just important historiographical arguments, but also ruminations on craft, on literary genre, and some great and really some really funny, some really powerful, and some really fascinating stories of individual women or characters, of men, and of lots and lots of different kinds of people and different kinds of texts. So I absolutely enjoyed talking with Beverly about it and reading the book, and I hope you enjoy listening and reading as well. We're here today to talk with Beverly Bossler about her new book, Courtesans, Concubines, and the Cult of Female Fidelity. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, Beverly, and thank you so much for making time to talk with me today.
Well, thank you. I'm just delighted to be here.
So could you start us off, as is traditional for New Books in East Asian Studies, by saying a little bit about yourself and your background? What brought you to the field of Chinese studies and a focus on China in the Song and the Yuan in particular?
Oh, my. Well, my interest in Chinese studies really came in through linguistics, and that was after a rather unusual background. After high school, I went to become a ballet dancer and ended up finally giving that up and ended up in college with not much sense at all of what I wanted to do. But I had a friend who was Chinese, and I had another friend who was studying Chinese linguistics at Columbia, and I was just very intrigued with the idea that it might be possible to learn this language. And when I ended up later as an undergraduate transferring out of the original school I went to Princeton, I decided I wanted to major in East Asian studies. And from there, I got really interested not only in the language, but the culture. And Princeton had a very strong Song history faculty at that time. And it just, the field of Song just really appealed to me.
Princeton's a great place to study China. I know from experience.
Yeah,
so big shout out to Princeton and their China Studies program.
Right.
So the book that we're talking about today explores the transformations in gender relations in China and in concepts of gender in China as well from the 10th through the 14th centuries by looking carefully at the categories of courtesans, concubines, and faithful wives, three categories of women that both intersected, kind of bled into each other, and also mutually shaped one another. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to this particular topic for this book? How does this fall within the larger trajectory of your research, and what brought you here?
It was a very organic and natural kind of falling into it. My first book looked at families. I was very interested in Chinese families and the dynamics of families. If I hadn't been a historian, maybe I would have been an anthropologist. And my first book wrote about women and marriage to a large extent, but was not really focused on gender. It was focused on the way family and marriage conditioned political status and social status. When I finished that book, I decided to move more into gender, partly under the influence of my wonderful colleague, Susan Mann, at the time, and began to look at what you could find out about women. And I had used a lot of funerary inscriptions for my first book, so I knew that those were there. And I thought, well, let me look into literacy. And as I started to look into how evidence for women writing, I was struck by how a great deal of the evidence actually referred not to the upper class women commemorated in funerary inscriptions, but rather to courtesans. And I was so shocked because, of course, I had been brought up to believe that the Song was a time of very sort of moral philosophy, where moral philosophy was really important. And the idea that there had been courtesans floating around, I mean, this was not the late Ming, right? This was the Song. And so I was amazed to discover that there was actually evidence on courtesans. And that got me very excited to try to find out more. And this happened to be just about the time when the electronic Siku Chenshu, the electronic database of which really contains about 90% or more of surviving Song sources, became text searchable and available. And that allowed me to look for evidence on courtesans in ways that would have been impossible had I just had to leaf through millions of, well, that wouldn't have been millions, but thousands of individual note collections or other kinds of sources. So I was able to really focus in on what I could find out. And that, as research tends to do, led me one topic to another, right? Oh, well, there are different kinds of courtesans. Ah, who knew? And, well, what would that mean? So that's how it kind of developed.
I mean, you've already actually just alluded to this a little bit, but because you raised the issue of the impact of databases and searchable text databases in particular on research, I think a lot of us have found this in our own work. It's really dramatically changed the kinds of things that are possible and also the kinds of books that we write right now, you know, given that this is a research methodology. I mean, are there any ways, and again, I know you just mentioned this a little bit, but that you felt that the course of doing this research in this particular way with these databases actually changed or shaped in a different way or a surprising way the kinds of questions you were asking about your material?
Because it lets you see the data in a slightly different perspective, and it has, I think this process has both positive and negatives, advantages and disadvantages. I was able to find a lot of data that I would not have otherwise been able to have access to about courtesans, but it can lead you to, this is not quite directly answering your question, but it can lead you to losing the perspective of the larger, of the source, the particular source that you were looking at. Now, how that affects the questions that you ask, I would guess, I'd say two things. One is, it is partly a result of that process that I am looking at such a large time period here.
Right.
On the other hand, this was a topic that if you, the data is sparse enough that if you tried to do it in a very limited time period, you probably wouldn't have much to say. So it allows you to take this broader perspective, I guess. And whether that's how that leads to, well, ignoring some of the more subtle changes that happen, that may be an issue, but it does allow you to look more broadly, I guess would be the obvious thing I'd say.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much. And I think it does, even thinking about what we're doing in terms of, and I do this as well, and I think a lot of us do right now, in terms of data, are making explicit issues of scale in the kind of historiography that we're writing, I think this is very much, at least in part, a result of these kinds of technologies that are shaping research. And it's really wonderfully done in the book. The book covers, you know, five centuries of transformations. And I think at the same time, and this is something that I was going to mention in the intro, but I'll just go ahead and mention it now, at the same time that the book is showing transformations on this vast scale, you're also very, very sensitive to the nature of the sources that you're talking about. And you zoom in specifically on that issue at several points throughout the book. So I found that really helpful as a reader and also as a way to understand how to contextualize these large-scale transformations within the material textual record. So the book covers, as I mentioned, nearly five centuries, and this is a period in which there were some dramatic transformations in society, in politics, in intellectual life, and in lots of other aspects of the kind of social, political, and intellectual worlds that you're talking about here. This period saw, among other things, as you mentioned early in the book, the dramatic growth of a literate elite class, the development of a local elite, changes and sometimes quite profound changes in kinship relations, and an articulation and development of something that we can call a neo-Confucian philosophy. And as we'll go through the parts of the book, and the parts of the book are separated into chapters that each coalesce around a particular time period, so chapters around the Northern Song, Southern Song, and then Yuan, we're going to see sequentially the ways that transformations in society, in politics, and culture really reshaped and transformed these three categories that you mentioned at the beginning of the book and of our conversation: courtesans, concubines, and the cult of female fidelity. So part one of the book, let's kind of dive right in. Part one looks at the ways that the growth of commerce and expansion of the elite class contributed to a kind of commercialization of the bodies of women, both for entertainment and for reproduction. You talk in these chapters, which are focused on the late Northern Song, how political debates paid special attention to the roles of concubines and families, to the faithfulness of upper-class widows, and also you talk about popular genres of writing about romantic fidelity, which start to be deployed by people to talk about other types of faithful women, not just faithful courtesans. Okay, so let's jump into chapter one now that I've laid that out. Chapter one, one of the themes that comes out here in this chapter on courtesans and the Northern Song elite is this transformation in terms of the extreme moralization of political rhetoric. And you talk here about how moralization of politics and political rhetoric actually helps transform or affect new ways of thinking about and talking about courtesans in this context. So maybe this is a good place to start. Could you talk about that a little bit and how that is interacting with or intersecting with the other themes or arguments of this chapter?
I think a couple of things are going on. One is the very virulent factionalism of the late Northern Song court, which Song specialists have studied in some detail. The gendered language of which has been largely overlooked. And that gendered language, I think, comes in partly because the concerns of some of the concerns in the factional politics had to do with the way society was being destabilized, I think, by the growing prevalence of these commodified women in Song culture. And that had to do with what, as you've already noted, the sort of growing economy and growth of this elite class. But it also had to do with urbanization, with the rise of printing, and especially with the getting rid of sumptuary laws that had really restricted concubinage, at least theoretically, in other eras. And the Song really just abandons those and lets anybody take a concubine who wants to. And so that creates new problems in the society that I think lead to some of that focus that in the Song factional politics on these issues.
What were some of the arguments that were leveled against people who were taking courtesans in terms of their morality or official behavior? Mm-hmm. What were some of the complaints?
Well, there are two kinds of things that are going on, and I argue over the course of the book that the nature of the complaints changes a little bit. In the Northern Song, there are still concerns about status. This is a period when China was shifting from an aristocratic style status, a society where your family position, your background mattered, to a society where, because of economic possibilities, there's increasingly value on actually not having upper class background, on being able to pull yourself up. But there are still debates about this. There are debates about whether we should allow merchants, for example, to take the examinations. And given that performers had always been mostly slaves and therefore not even considered to be of good common or much less of elite status, the idea that you would have performers in the household, the idea that elite men in government service would be aligning themselves with these debased persons, that was a huge issue in the Northern Song. There are also issues about one of the arguments I make here about whether the way a man runs his household has an impact on his ability to be a successful official. And those two come up in these debates that you see in the late Northern Song. I mean, if a man is not able to control the women in his household, if they're and there's one famous murder case where a concubine murders a slave girl, and this becomes a cause célèbre. The man is indicted, but the trial drags on. And there's considerable debate over whether this is a red herring, that if he's a good official, what goes on in his household shouldn't matter, or on the contrary, no, what the moral status of his household is a critical measure of a man's capability to be an official.
Thank you. Now, each of the chapters opens with a short vignette about a particular woman that serves as a model for understanding what's going to continue to be argued later on in that chapter. So chapter one opens with virtuous courtesan Wen Wan, and I won't ask you to talk about that too much so that we can move on to the second chapter, but I just want to mark that for listeners because it's one of the things about the book that really is very effective in drawing our attention to these women as individuals. In particular cases.
Well, it's as you know, very hard to get. These are all biographies of women written by men. To the extent they're individuals, it's a very mediated sense of who they are. But I think it's interesting to have the stories there, and they are evocative, I think.
That's right. Now, in chapter two, one of the individuals, well, again, in this mediated sense of individuality, but at least individuals who we are able to meet in the narrative, even as we are being thoughtful about the fact that they are mediated and perhaps aggregate or composite, narrativized individuals, is so one of these individuals who's really interesting here is the love of the life of Su Shi. So the chapter, the second chapter, opens with Su Shi memorializing the young woman who he had loved called Morning Cloud. Can you introduce that story for us, even just briefly, and talk a little bit about how that is situated within the larger transformations happening in this chapter?
Well, as best we know, and we know most about Morning Cloud from Su Shi's own poetry. She was a young woman brought into his house at a very young age. I think it was 9, if I'm remembering correctly. And it becomes apparent from some of his poetry, although people haven't really remarked on this much before, that she was an entertainer, that she danced. And he had several of these courtesan, concubine, handmaids, whatever you want to call them, entertainer concubines. But she was the one that stayed with him. Ultimately, she had a child by him when he was sent in exile. She was the only one to go with him. And he, you know, his relationship with her actually was much celebrated by later in the Ming Dynasty when people were interested in talking about romantic relationships. They went back to Su Shi and Morning Cloud. So that helped me because there was some data about her. I think I didn't understand her very well until I did this broader research about the kind of institutions that were there for these kinds of young women. She was born in a, you know, modest family. We don't know much about her background, but clearly she was somebody who became his partner in spite of the fact that he had two wives, who he's very respectful of in his writing, but not passionate about, whereas there is some passion in his writing about Morning Cloud.
So you mentioned in this chapter that one of the things that at least in the perspective of one reader, one of the things that's really interesting about this figure of Morning Cloud is that she does represent this new model of entertainers or entertaining concubines who are in households. And this sort of brings us to one of the other really interesting arguments in this chapter, which is you're arguing here that status distinctions between different types of concubines and also between them and legal wives become really important to family life in this period in a new way. So would you mind talking about that a little bit?
Right. Well, entertainer concubines are not really new in this period. You can go back to the Han, the Six Dynasties, and you'll see that in the households of important people, there were entertainer concubines. Well, there were entertainers. They were called ji, or the term that we use for courtesan. And they were slaves. And they did occasionally have children. And there's some evidence that in these earlier periods that an entertainer who had a child might be raised to the manumitted and then raised to the status of concubine, because technically legally concubines were supposed to be people of non-slave status, of good commoner status. What happens in the Song, I'm arguing, is that because of the growing economy, because the shift in ideas about status, all of those categories are breaking down, but the terms stay the same. So you still talk about a ji in a household, but now the distinction between a ji, who is technically a slave or an indentured servant, and a concubine just gets completely elided. That distinction just blurs to where nobody, the vocabulary gets used interchangeably and so forth. And so with that shift, and with the breakdown of these status categories, the distinction between a concubine and a wife starts to get a little bit slippery as well. And the fact that the children of concubines could be legitimate sons, or were considered legitimate sons, also contributes to that. So it starts to be that the only kind of thing that holds the status together is a man's willingness to give his wife a special position. Legally, she has one, but in the emotional dynamics, that doesn't always hold up. So all of this gets very, very messy, which again contributes to these kind of debates and concerns that get worked out in court as well as elsewhere that we talked about earlier.
Now, as we move from this to the third chapter, Prose, Politics, and Prodigies, we see here the first stage of a heightened interest, as I think you put it in this chapter, in female fidelity in this song. Now, you mentioned here, I mean, contrary to what some of us might have thought or might sort of take for granted, which is, you know, we take for granted this discourse of fidelity and widowhood. You argue here, I think really convincingly, that the emphasis on the fidelity of widows, and in fact on widows themselves in this period, was actually rather new. So this seems very important, and I'd love if you talk about this a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, we all know, right, that way back in the Lian Yuzhuan, to be a faithful wife, to be a widow who refuses to leave the inner quarters in a fire or whatever, was a really valorized thing. And fidelity is always admired. But it's very, very clear that in Song, lots of upper-class women remarried. It was not an expectation that an upper-class woman would stay a widow, would stay faithful to her deceased husband the way it does become in the Ming and the Qing. And people have known this for a while, and so the question is, well, why does this happen in the Song? One of the arguments that I'm trying to make is that it happens precisely because these boundaries between courtesans and concubines and wives are getting so slippery, and that for a wife to remain faithful is one way she distinguishes herself from the concubine, because concubines are routinely married out or sold off, if you will, when their husbands die. So a wife that's also goes off and remarries looks, again, like a concubine. A wife that doesn't looks more like a wife.
And at the same time, and perhaps ironically, though this is, if you think about it, this makes a lot of sense. At the same time, what's happening is that writings about the devotion and the romantic devotion of entertainers are actually used as templates to celebrate loyalty of upper-class wives and the fidelity. And so even though there's this social distinction being made, at the same time, narratively, there's a movement from one category to the other.
Well, it's not just that the narrative, but the writing about upper class women. You have new kinds of writing about upper class women in the Tang and even in the early Song. Upper class women are written about largely in funerary inscriptions. And even there's a rhetoric that says, well, we shouldn't write funerary inscriptions of upper class women because, after all, a good woman's name is not known outside the household. But what starts to happen is, along with circulation, and here I'm sure printing is also a factor, circulation of stories about courtesans and about the paramours, concubines of upper class men, you start to get people wanting to celebrate faithful wives. And I also argue in this chapter that another factor that comes in here is the fraught political situation of the Northern Song, that loyalty of men becomes an important issue. And one way to shame men into loyalty, if you will, is to point out how women are staying loyal. And it gets very messy because you're talking about widows on one hand, but then on another hand, you're talking about women who refuse to be raped by invading soldiers. And so that rhetoric of that fidelity gets conflated with rhetoric about faithful widows.
Right, and that's actually, we see that also in Chapter 6,
which
is a really, really powerful, I think, case of that. So as we move, though, so before we get to Chapter 6, let's move more generally to Part 2 of the book, in which Chapter 6 is embedded. So we've just moved from Part 1, which is Northern Song, to Part 2, which focuses on the Southern Song. These chapters in Part 2, 4, 5, and 6 look at how the popularity of courtesans and concubines spreads throughout Southern Song society and some of the ramifications of that. Now, Chapter 4, in this, you talk about the impact of printing and print media on commercialization of women, of women's bodies, of commodification of all kinds of things related to them. You talk about the ways that as female entertainers become more numerous, there are more and more complaints about disruptions to families and to governments. We see the Northern Song collapsing in 1127. The Southern Song dissolves the Court Entertainment Bureau. All kinds of wonderful things are going on in this chapter. So for listeners, I direct your attention. There's a lot of richness in this chapter that's really fascinating as a kind of transition point from the kinds of phenomena that we're talking about before. Now, what I want to ask you to talk about, if you wouldn't mind for a little bit, you again, we see in this chapter, albeit in a slightly different way, many complaining about the negative influence of courtesans. And here it's on local government offices and blaming of courtesans for a kind of general decline in morality. But at the same time, and this is an interesting counterpoint, this is what I would love if you could talk a little bit about, at the same time as this, there's actually a really a growing interest in seeing courtesans as human beings, as the humanity of courtesans, and as examples or exemplars of ethical behavior. So at the same time, we're blaming them for a downfall in morality and also seeing them as exemplars of ethical behavior. So can you talk a little bit about where is this humanizing of courtesans coming from, and how does it happen that they're seen as ethical paragons at the same time that they're blamed for moral downfall?
Yeah, you definitely have two contrary trends going on at the same time. As entertainers become more prevalent in the society, you do have precisely this really strong concern that local government is being disrupted, partly because, as I discuss, I think it's in chapter five, chapter four, the entertainers at the local government offices become brokers for people who want lawsuits fixed, who want to reach the prefect or reach the county magistrate, and they know that he's hanging around with the courtesans, so they approach the courtesans to get help with their lawsuits. And there's a wonderful, wonderful indictment that we have from Zhu Xi about exactly this kind of situation. So that's the sort of sense that they are in this position of power that they don't belong in and they can't be trusted, just like clerks and runners can't be trusted. That's one line of discussion. At the same time, and here I do invoke Lynn Hunt and her work on the novel and its role in Europe in sort of creating the idea that all people have feelings, that all people have a right to their own individuality. The idea that all of these circulating stories about courtesans, in which they are often heroines and faithful to their lovers and so forth, I think starts to change attitudes toward courtesans. This is related to, I think, also Neo-Confucian ideas about that everyone is endowed with this a good heart. It goes back to Mencius, but that everyone, it's revived by the Neo-Confucians, that everyone has the capacity to be a moral person, no matter how lowly. This is a very different kind of social ethic than you saw in the Tang, where aristocratic status, morality, the ability to be moral comes with birthright, with being a cult, being from an upper-class family. Now anybody can is believed to have some kind of basic moral predisposition, if you will, that can be cultivated. Like women, in the rhetoric of that's trying to encourage male fidelity, since the Southern Song government is also still worried about this, courtesans who are loyal are an even more powerful emblem of for shaming men. And look, if a courtesan, a lowly courtesan, can be loyal like this, why can't the men be? So that idea that courtesans are individuals, that lower class people in general are individuals, is getting broadcast through short stories, through anecdotes, and I argue toward the end of drama as well.
Right. Now, you just mentioned Zhu Xi, and that actually really beautifully brings us to another thing that I wanted to ask you as we move to the next chapter. So you evoked the case in which, and I want to just highlight this for listeners because I loved this. Zhu Xi is actually indicting his colleague Tang Zhongyu and claiming that his keeping of courtesans actually brought about this drought. And so there's wonderful sort of cosmological resonance story in there too. In the next chapter, we also see Zhu Xi And here, Juxi is upholding the recognition of concubines as mothers. So this, I think, is a really good example that brings up two related things that are happening in this part of the book that I think are really important and that we haven't, one of which is something that's very important to the book itself that we haven't yet had a chance to touch on. So this is a great place for that. So how, when we think of Juxi, we think of Neo-Confucian scholars. So how in this period are Neo-Confucian scholars dealing with the institution, for example, of concubinage? Where does Neo-Confucian scholarship come in here? And why are concubines taken seriously as mothers in a new way in this period?
Well, I think there are a lot of complex things going on here, but for the Neo-Confucians are very concerned about family relations. They're concerned about proper ethical relations between human beings, and that starts in the family. And in this context, you see people like Juxi, and this is something you start to see even in the Northern Song, a new rhetoric about concubines, and Juxi sort of exemplifies it as he is consolidating Neo-Confucian philosophy in the Southern Song. He particularly addresses this issue on numerous occasions. Question is, if your mother was a concubine, how are you supposed to treat her? How are you supposed to mourn her? Traditionally and legally still in the Song, the main wife, the father's legitimate wife, not his concubines, were nominally the mothers of all children. They are the legal mothers. You owed your legal mother your respect and filial piety. But this left a question of how you were supposed to treat your concubine mother. And for people like Juxi, who believe in a kind of morality that is inborn and that comes out of basic human relations, the idea that you could somehow ignore your concubine mother is anathema. And so Juxi writes very clearly. He says, well, of course you have to, you know, mourn and properly uphold the status of your legal mother. But at the same time, you must be properly filial to your concubine mother. And he stipulates all kinds of new rituals. There are court debates about this kind of thing. Can you enfeof a concubine mother? How can you honor a concubine mother? And Juxi is very concerned that people take care of their concubine mothers, keep them in the household, respect them, be filial to them, because he's coming from a position that says basic human relationships are how all morality starts.
Mm-hmm. And I was, this is something that I was going to save to the end, but since we're on this topic now, and talking a little bit about Neo-Confucianism in the context of this part of the book, I think it's a good time to just step out a little bit and mention and mark and perhaps talk a little bit about the ways that the book is engaging and helping us transform the way we think about Neo-Confucianism in this period, more broadly writ. So I wonder, do you want to speak to that now? Because that does seem to be a really important part of the kind of work that the book is doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this was something that, as often happens when we're doing research, you go in thinking that you understand what's going on and you're expecting it to be a certain way. And then the more you read and the more you look at the sources, it doesn't quite fit. And I went in with the sort of general assumption that some of the changes, at least, that I was going to be looking at or was seeing in how concubines were treated began with Neo-Confucianism, that it was a moral rhetoric that was established in the Northern Song and that began to spread in Southern Song and changed the way the society viewed itself. But the more I looked at the sources, the more it seemed to be that you saw this certain kinds of rhetoric that we attribute to Neo-Confucianism actually emerging first in the rhetoric of other people, of people who were not Neo-Confucian philosophers. And only later did the Neo-Confucians actually pick up this rhetoric and systematize it. So as I've already suggested, there are debates in Northern Song, even at court, about, well, how should emperors treat their concubine mothers who were not empresses? And how, you know, what should the laws be about this? It's only in Juxi, much, much later, that we start to get a discussion in the Neo-Confucian philosophical context of why this is important and why you should, you know, be careful of your concubine mother. Now, another interesting factor there, of course, is that the Neo-Confucians are concerned about human desire and the way that that destabilizes human relationships. So they're in this very tricky position of having to argue concubines are important. They're important for the imperative of having children, which is a Confucian good. On the other hand, they don't want men to have desires. And so there's this, I think, for me anyway, it was a pretty funny section where I'm describing the rhetoric, which basically tells men you should have concubines, but you should not want to sleep with them, and that the concubines, you should have wives who want you to have concubines because they want you to have sons and they're not at all jealous. And you get this kind of new vision of the ideal couple where she's encouraging the husband to have concubines and the husband is saying, no, I don't want a concubine. So it's kind of amusing.
Now, as we move to the later part of the book, we move to chapter 6, and we've already talked a little bit about this, or at least invoked what's happening in this really interesting chapter. This is a chapter in which, as you mentioned a little bit before, literati begin to commemorate the loyalty and the martyrdom of upper-class women as a way to try to encourage political loyalty in men. So is there anything more that you wanted to say about that? It's a really fascinating case study for, I think, not only for people interested in political history, but also here for another case in which we have analogous or literary analogies being used to transform a kind of argument from one category of people to another category of people. Mm-hmm. So it's also interesting in terms of literary genres.
Right. I mean, to put it rather simply, I mean, I do think that what goes on is there is this upsurge in writing about faithful widows. It really begins in the late Northern Song, but it gets much broader in the Southern Song as people commemorate, actually less faithful widows, but as women who died in the invasions and died refusing to be raped by invaders. But this rhetoric gets more and more prevalent, and gradually by the end of Southern Song, you see that same kind of rhetoric emerging in places like funerary inscriptions for faithful widows. And that's a new thing in the rhetoric for faithful women, to make such an issue of not just that she's faithful and she's done all these great things for the family, but that she's personally faithful to her husband. And it comes out of, again, both, I think, the political situation, but as we've already discussed a little bit, the rhetoric of personal fidelity of courtesan lovers to their husbands. So you have all of this now emerging in writings for faithful women in Southern Song, still mostly in funerary inscriptions, but also beginning to emerge in other genres that had not been used to write about women before, such as upper class women before, such as poetry prefaces and colophons to biographies, things like that.
Now, as we move to the third part of the book and we move from the Southern Song to the Yuan, we also move explicitly to another, what we might consider as or talk about in the context of another genre of writing, and that is narrative drama. Mm-hmm. So part three of the book moves us into the Yuan and shows a number of important transformations. So in this part of the book, you are arguing here, and again, I think really compellingly, that literati men, come increasingly to appreciate courtesans' talents and their humanity. Mm-hmm. You mention here that the entertainment functions of concubines are increasingly downplayed, and the idealized role of concubines becomes closer to that of wives. And there are many other kinds of transformations happening here. In the seventh chapter of the book, Exemplary Entertainers, you look closely at the development of full-scale narrative drama in this period in the Yuan. You argue here that the popularity of these dramas especially those that are depicting the feelings of entertainers, is actually contributing to a transformation in broader perceptions of them. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this this phenomenon, this sort of depictions of entertainers in drama having larger cultural and social shifts in terms of the way that they're perceived more broadly.
Mm-hmm. Again, this goes back to an analogy, I think, with the point that Lin Hun makes, but that in China, it's really not in novels or short stories or letters that this happens, but in drama, precisely because drama, the arias in Chinese drama, is where people express their perspectives on the world, their heartfelt emotions. They really tell you who they are. And a striking number of the hero of the leading characters in Yuan drama turn out to be courtesans, turn out to be entertainers. And over again, we see the loyal entertainer, the faithful entertainer. They're always their heroines. Even in the one drama where the nominal heroine is actually a bad courtesan who keeps going back, who is faithless and hopeless and keeps going back to the courtesan profession. The lead narratives, the lead arias are all sung not by that character, but by various heroic sister courtesans who try to persuade her to do the right thing. So over and over again in Yuan drama, you have courtesans as heroines pouring out their hearts, evoking sympathy, being very sympathetic characters. And I think this starts to change attitudes, especially along with the fact that a lot of literati men are suddenly finding themselves under the UN government, disenfranchised, unable to, unappreciated themselves. I mean, it's they're now in a much more likely position to be empathetic, we might say, with people whose talents are not always appreciated.
Now, as we move from the treatment of courtesans in Chapter 7, we then move to Chapter 8, where we also see transformations in this second category of women that we're talking about throughout the book, and that is concubines. You argue in this part of the book that concubines are being domesticated, and that this actually has large ramifications for how not only Yuan writers of various genres are dealing with this, and how sort of broader societal notions again of concubines, but also how this dovetails with Neo-Confucian thought, or learning of the way, rather, thought. So can you talk about what does this mean to say that concubines are being domesticated, and what are the larger ramifications of that fear?
Okay, well, first of all, I want to give a shout out to Neil Katkoff, who originally wrote a really wonderful PhD dissertation looking at the domestication of concubines strictly in law from Tang to Ming. So that term domestication is his, and he deserves credit for it. But what he saw in the legal sources, I found very much borne out in other kinds of sources, particularly funerary inscriptions for women and the way concubines and concubines' children are talked about in those funerary inscriptions. Increasingly, you see de-emphasis, as you've already suggested, on the entertainment functions and emphasis on concubines as mothers, and also new emphasis on the way concubines' children should be taught. And this dovetails with Neo-Confucianism, once again, in the Confucian concern for family relations, and in particular for the concern about the way families can be stabilized by tensions between half-brothers, brothers of the wife, sons of the wife, sons of the first concubine, the second concubine, and so forth. Often the sons of the concubine are as much as a generation younger than their brothers. And one of the things the Confucians become very upset about is the fact that rather than treating all the brothers as equal co-parceners in estates, brothers are letting their half-brothers inherit from them. And this disrupts all kinds of notions of generational hierarchy and so forth. And Neo-Confucian writers get quite upset about that. And they're very, very anxious that the family stay together and that brothers stay together.
Great. Now, as we move from this to the last chapter, in which we look again at fidelity and especially faithful widows, we have a transformation from something that we just saw in the analogous position in the previous chapter, which looks at the Southern Song. So whereas in the Southern Song, we saw cases in which virtuous women were being upheld, or loyal women were being upheld as models for men, here we have faithful widows being held up not as models for men in the Yuan, but instead for other women. So can you talk about that? Why is that important, and what are the reasons for that shift?
Well, I think part of the, I'll start, take the second part first.
Sure.
I mean, I think part of the reason for that shift is that it's just the proliferation of writing about faithful women. And it really isn't in the Song that you see the huge proliferation. It takes off exponentially in the Yuan. And it takes off in the Yuan in large part, I think, because there are particular social and political and monetary advantages to having your mother named a faithful wife. The UN government gives tax remission, especially corvée remission. Corvée levies were very onerous in the UN. So for a disenfranchised literati class that can no longer depend on participation in the examinations to get them tax remission, having a faithful wife mother is another way to get that tax remission. So I think there are very real sort of monetary reasons that happens. Once that does happen, though, and this rhetoric of fidelity and these texts just start proliferating all over the place. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of poems and poetry prefaces written for faithful wives. I think gradually what had been, you know, holding up faithful women as a model for men starts to become just by sheer repetition a sense that this is what women should be doing. This is women. This, you know, it's telling us over and over about faithful women, and oh yes, I guess that's women are supposed to be faithful. And so in biographies of women from the UN more generally, where you used to see a lot of different kinds of things, values highlighted, increasingly fidelity becomes the signal value that defines a good woman. Why is this important? Is that it as we move into the Ming and the Qing, it makes female fidelity, again, the major virtue for women. And as that spreads, it has all kinds of ramifications for women's property, women's remarriage, and so forth.
And what you just said actually speaks to one of the, in addition to the way that the book is asking us to rethink the role of Neo-Confucianism in the Song and Yuan, it's also asking us at the same time to rethink gender, to gender order in late imperial China and the ways that those foundations were set within the Song and the Yuan. And so you just mentioned that briefly in the last part of your comment. I wonder if you could expand on that more broadly as we come to the conclusion of our conversation. How more broadly, perhaps using that example, but then talking about, you know, any other aspects of this that you'd like, does this case change the way we think about gender and gender history in late imperial China and the Ming and Qing and beyond specifically?
Primarily, I think that the myth has been that Neo-Confucians came in the Song, established this new gender order. It's all their fault, right? And that women were sort of rendered less powerful and in later imperial China, and it all happened that way. I'm trying to argue that the development was much more complex, that it was in many cases, what we're seeing is this new regime for women of this fidelity regime for women. I'm arguing it's really the result of unintended consequences. It certainly was not the Neo-Confucians, who are rather late to pick up on that whole idea to begin with. Implications for understanding later imperial, I think you know, to first of all, to see that it isn't the Ming where this all starts, that it definitely starts in the earlier period. And it certainly, as Katie Carless has shown, expands in the Ming in new ways. But it's really an ongoing change throughout that entire period. That would be the main thing, I guess, that I'm thinking of. There are also arguments about that I make about masculinity, the ways that ideas about women, ideas of and men's relationships with women shape what our image of the ideal, or what the Chinese image of the ideal male is, and how that is historically conditioned. It seems to cycle. You once again in late Ming, you have the cult of Qing, you have romance valorized, you have literati men's romances with courtesans valorized. This is something that happened in the Song and is repeated in the Ming. So seeing these cycles, I think, is another important aspect of how my book maybe changes our view of late imperial period.
Well, Beverly, thank you so much again for making the time. It's an amazing book. This is, I think, already, I mean, you'd mentioned it's already in a second printing, right? So it's already becoming, I think, an absolute must read for anyone who works on the history of Imperial China, certainly for anyone interested in history of family, of Neo-Confucianism, of law, of women, of gender, and of any number of other kinds of phenomena in this broad historical context that we're talking about. So congratulations on the book. It's an amazing book. It's an important book, and it's going to be one of our foundational books, if not already. There's a lot in the book, that said, and it's an extraordinarily rich story. There was, of course, a ton of material that we didn't have a chance to get to in the course of our conversation in an hour. Is there anything in particular that we didn't have a chance to talk about, but that you'd like to mention for listeners?
Well, at this point, I think we've got through most of the main points that I see as significant in the book. So I think we're all right at this point.
Great. And I will mention also, as we're on this, the cover is also quite beautiful.
It's a very
beautiful cover. So now that the book is out, and again, congratulations on that and on the second printing, what's next for you? What project or projects are inspiring you at the moment?
I'm futzing around with a bunch of things. I had been working for a while on ideas about male connection and maybe about male-male relationships, friendship, and so forth. But I'm finding myself also intrigued, and the two aren't really mutually exclusive, but with thinking about what emotion means in China and in China in the Song in the Yuan, and how ideas about emotion, ideas about love might have been shifting in that period. I'm not sure yet whether it's a project that can really be done. I haven't had a chance to get enough into the sources to really see whether it's possible, but it's something that intrigues me, and I'd like to try to pursue at least.
Well, best of luck on that. That sounds also like a great project. So I'll look forward to talking to you about that when it's out as well. Thank you again, Beverly. Best of luck with the new project. And again, thank you so much for making time.
Well, thank you, Carla. It's really been fun.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks very much for joining us, and we'll see you next time.